Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 292. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, is John Lindemann.
I, for one, welcome my new Quebecois overlord.
That's right. We also have, joining us for the first time as a regular member of the podcast, our new editor, Guillaume Veillette.
Raped and pillaged another podcast, did you?
Yes. Yes, Guillaume, we are very happy to have you here. Unfortunately, James couldn't be here this week. It's just a temporary absence. He had some people visiting in town, and unfortunately, he really felt bad about it, too, this being your first week and all. But presumably, we'll have James back next week, and we'll really get started with our foursome. It's kind of a boon for you, Guillaume, because it means editing will be probably a little bit easier this week with only three people on the show.
And this show, it also guarantees that this show will be all Guillaume all the time.
I'm pretty sure this is a sign that, like, the show is falling apart. I expected it. Like, no one cares anymore.
Yes. The slow decline begins now. We're in our listen up zone here, so just get ready, people. We have big plans, big dreams, and big hopes for the future of this podcast, and we're very, very happy to have Guillaume on board. And we certainly are going to miss Greg, and I did want to James had a very, very heartfelt and beautiful post in TalkBack for last week's episode. I love peeling back the sarcasm on James Jones. He's a very, very sweet guy underneath the surface, and you don't get to see it often enough. So that's one of my ongoing goals, is to always kind of penetrate James's evil facade and get to the good-hearted soul.
There indeed is a heart that beats beneath that cold, callous shell of his.
And you could hear it on the last episode. You really could. I've heard that before, but rarely. So it was nice
usually
to hear,
under the influence of alcohol, but we won't go into that.
Yeah, but I did just want to say, we have gotten all the feedback and all the really nice emails and forum posts and everything that people have sent, and I know Greg really appreciates it, but we really appreciate it too, and it's been very, very touching to read what everybody has to say, and also especially to get people's support for the podcast, and best wishes for Guillaume going forward, and we're gonna put it to good use. We're gonna do a good job. So, yes, we have a listener mail coming up later in the episode. But first is new business, and I'll go first. I've got just a couple of fairly quick things here. First, I wanted to say that I downloaded the Mario Kart 7 patch, a momentous occasion patching a Nintendo game. Let me tell you.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And, you know, I think it's wonderful that Nintendo's doing this. You know, it's a shame that these shortcuts made it through the game, although I think pretty much every Mario Kart game has these kind of exploits. Mm-hmm. The difference is when you're playing online, they become really disruptive. You know, in terms of time trial and stuff like that, who cares? You know, they make for funny YouTube videos. But yeah, for online multiplayer where they're keeping track of your win losses and, you know, you're trying to be somewhat competitive, I think it really does help to have the ability to fix these things. And I'm really glad they're doing it. You know, it also shows that they're dedicated to, supporting their games after they come out. You know, and that's something that we haven't seen a lot from Nintendo over the years. You could argue they've never really needed to. I would say they have needed to, and they just didn't do anything about it in a lot of cases. So
yeah,
this is good. You know, I think the way they're delivering it is a little odd, because if you, I didn't try this, but apparently if you go in and try to play online without having the patch, you just get this message that says, go to the eShop and download the patch. Okay, that's good that they're communicating that, but really the game should be able to just download the patch automatically if you're getting online.
Yeah, with mine, it actually, I had Super Mario 3D Land in there, so I put in Mario Kart, and it actually came up and said, like, before I even had a chance to do anything, it said, there's a patch for this, do you want to download it?
Just when you put the card in the system?
Not when I put the card in, but as soon as I went to launch the game, it said, there's an update.
Okay.
So I don't even think I could launch the game without applying the update.
Well, anyway, I mean, I think it's a fairly easy process to get it from the eShop. I'm just saying it's a little odd that you have to go to an outside application to download the patch and then go back into the game again to actually, you know, use it. Yeah. But whatever. It's a pretty quick process. I think the whole thing could be streamlined a little bit in the future, but again, I'm very glad they're doing it. And this had the expected consequence. I'd been planning to do this ever since I heard about the patch, but I went back in and played more Mario Kart, which I had not done in quite a while. I don't even think I had turned it on since PAX East. And at the time, I was the only reason I was even turning it on was to collect street passes, you know. For what reason, I'm not totally sure, because the street pass mode in that game is not really very good. I mean, it doesn't really do anything. It just kind of downloads a kind of random ghost, but it's not even really the ghost of the person you street passed with. They've covered this on Famicast. It's just kind of a weird implementation. It doesn't really work like you would think that it would. But I did find out that apparently I've had enough Mario Kart 7 street passes that I got to unlock a new part for my carts, a new custom part. So that was kind of neat. At least I got something out of doing all those street passes. So anyway, I went in and played some online. I got to race against Neil and Alex from the staff. Boy was on there, and a few other recognizable names. Someone named Reggie. I don't think it was the real Reggie, but his me looked like Reggie at least.
Did he have golden pants or?
Nah, I don't think so. You can't really tell though in Mario Kart. You know, they don't really show the bottom. So anyway, I had a good time. You know, I thought the online worked pretty well. It worked as well as I remembered. And I didn't have to feel guilty about picking Maka Wuhu, because I actually really like that track, you know. And now all of a sudden, I mean, you could tell certainly there's a lot more variety in the tracks that are getting chosen. But that could also be because I was playing with our community, our NWR community, which you should join if you haven't. You know, go to the website. If you go to the forums, you'll find a thread where they have the code and everything that you put in. You know, you play in the community, you're going to get a higher quality of person, of competitor, who's not going to try to spam it.
Let's not make any assumptions.
It's true. I mean, you're not going to get the random person who's trying to use the exploits. But, you know, the exploits don't work anymore. So we definitely got a very good variety of tracks. And, you know, they worked really well. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Supposedly, if you played the game right after the patch came out, people still tried to use the shortcut, and it was just amazing. Like, you would see them just throw themselves in the pit and then have to race by themselves all alone, and you know, everyone else was just vindicated. Like, you see, it's not so fun to be racing alone, is it?
Yeah, I'm sure not everybody even knew that what the patch was for. They just applied it and didn't really realize that it was actually fixing the glitch.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry. Wah.
I will say, I mean, the one time I picked Maka Wuhu and it actually came up and we got to race on it, I think I got first place in that race. It might have been the only one that I got first place on. But that was a good feeling, and that's something I don't know that had ever happened online, because I wasn't good at doing the exploit, you know, so I usually just didn't even try.
Yeah.
And so I got used to being like fifth or sixth in Maka Wuhu.
Oh, so you were the only one who actually knew the track, apparently.
Yeah. I was the only person who'd actually ever raced on those parts that you would normally skip.
All that trading gave you a fair advantage.
Yeah.
Does the fact that the game is patchable, maybe you guys know this, like, does this mean that there's a possibility of downloading new tracks, or is it completely different?
That would be a lot of additional data.
Yeah.
Maybe they could do it on a technical level, but the game, just the code of the game, I don't think really has infrastructure to handle that.
Yeah.
And they would have to rewrite so much of it to handle a new track that the file size would probably just be enormous. It's not like one of these games that has these built-in hooks for DLC where there's this kind of platform of code that's generic that expects different modules of downloadable code to be plugged into it and to make it work. Mm-hmm. Mm. So I think you'd have to rewrite so much of the game that it's probably not something that they would do over a patch.
Yeah. Yeah. It just doesn't seem like it's the kind of game that Nintendo would ever do that with. You know, they typically like Mario Kart to just be the game that they just release for a particular platform, and that's the version of the game for the duration.
Which is why it was so essential to get a patch in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, yeah, this is the only Mario Kart we're getting on 3DS, more than likely. Mm-hmm. The other thing I played this week I wanted to talk about is The Walking Dead, Episode 1. And this is the new Telltale adventure game, point-and-click, sort of point-and-click adventure game. I got it on Steam, but it's also on Xbox 360 and PS3. Unfortunately, not coming to Wii, The Telltale does have quite a history with the Wii, because they had the, several years ago, I reviewed the Sam & Max, season one game. They had put all the downloadable episodes onto a disc and put that on Wii. Right. And it worked pretty well from an interface standpoint. I think that game, I'm not a huge fan of the kinds of puzzles that it did or the kind of story that it told, but you know, in terms of working on the platform, it worked fine. And then they did the Strong Bad game for WiiWare, and then they did Tales of Monkey Island. And I never played either one of those. Did you guys ever mess around with them?
Well, you know, I played Back to the Future, and I also I played the first episode of Tales of Monkey Island, but I never even finished the first episode. I got stuck.
Did you play it on WiiWare?
No, I played it on PC. I heard that the audio compression in the WiiWare version was just horrible.
I can imagine so, because all of their games, even going back to Sam & Max, have a lot of voice. And, you know, with the file limits on WiiWare with 40 megabytes, it seems really tricky to fit a lot of voice into that, you know, amount of space. With Strong Bad, I'm not really sure how they did it. I'm sure there was voice in it, but I don't know if every bit of dialogue was voiced. That would be
hard to do. It was, but there wasn't that much of it. You know, if you clicked on an object, you wouldn't say 10 different things, you know, about the potted plant or whatever.
Oh, right.
So it was kind of limited that way.
Well, The Walking Dead is very heavily voiced, and that's actually one of my favorite things about it, because not only is there just a lot of voice acting, but it's really, really good across the board. And this is something that you very rarely see in video games, when it feels like every single character in the game is properly cast and properly directed and actually takes the character seriously and doesn't sound like a cliche. And it's even more important in The Walking Dead, because I don't know if you guys are familiar with the comics or the TV show, but it takes place in Georgia. So you've got all these Southern accents, and those are incredibly easy to fuck up.
Yes.
on an actor's part. And, you know, being from the South myself, and I'm sure, John, you would be sensitive to this as well, but I notice when there's a bad Southern accent in something, and there aren't any in The Walking Dead. I mean, I'm just kind of amazed that they got actors who could all do this and who all sounded really authentic and really just of the place that they are.
Well, and that they would care enough to do so, right?
Exactly. Well, I'm not surprised that they care, because I think without the voice acting and without the story, you know, these games just don't have a lot left. I mean, that is at least half of the reason that you would play them.
Yeah.
And especially being based on The Walking Dead, which is literally a comic book. You know, I mean, it is all story. So I'm just amazed that they executed on it this well. It's really, really impressive. And I think the whole game actually is pretty fantastic. I mean, you can play through it in about 2 hours, but, you know, there'll be four more episodes, coming out one a month. So, and I've already prepaid for all of them, and I am really excited to play more of this now. I think one of the wonderful things about it being 2 hours long is that it's not nearly long enough for you to get sick of it. You know, so it really does leave you wanting more. And the nice thing is there will be more. And you know that it's coming within a pretty reasonable amount of time. So it's a really great length of content. And it is so the great thing is that it just feels like there's no padding in it. And in Sam & Max, I felt like there was a lot of padding. I felt like there was a lot of really obscure puzzles that basically just required you to talk to every single character in the world that you had access to about 3 times. And basically just try every single possible permutation of the items and the topics that your characters had accumulated. And The Walking Dead really just doesn't have any of that stuff. There's a lot of scripted events where you're just kind of going through dialogue trees and testing out the character interactions. There's only, I would say, probably only 2 or 3 puzzles in the entire first episode. And the nice thing about the puzzles is they really feel like they make sense within the context of the world. And I think this is something I didn't anticipate when I heard that they were doing a Walking Dead game. I thought, well, you know, not really surprised, because it's a big property. It's really popular. It's a kind of genre that Telltale hasn't really done before. So it makes sense that they would want to try it out. And it's a brand that has a lot of name recognition. So it's good for them in order to sell it to a lot of people who might not otherwise play a point and click adventure game. But the thing that really is so perfect about this matchup is that The Walking Dead and a lot of zombie movies, but certainly, especially in this particular zombie universe, you've got these people who are really survivalists and they're not going to win against the zombies. They're just trying to survive. And they've got weapons, but in general, they can't really use guns because the zombies in this world are attracted to sound. So there's a lot of, in a lot of cases, they're using things that they found around the environment as makeshift weapons because they're a lot quieter. And so one of the best puzzles and probably the one single biggest puzzle in this episode of The Walking Dead is you're moving through this, like motel parking lot, and it's full of like four or five different zombies, and you have to take them out one at a time. And in each case, you have to find something that you can use as a weapon to take out that zombie without alerting the other ones. And so it is in some sense a kind of traditional point and click puzzle because you're searching around for something that you can use, and then you're figuring out what you can use it on. And in a lot of games, that can feel really, really arbitrary. But in this game, it totally makes sense within the fiction that they've created. And everything that you do feels practical. It feels like, oh, of course, that, you know, if you kind of put your head in the character and put yourself in those shoes, solving the puzzle is a logical progression of steps. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what you would want to do if you were there and if you had these things at hand. And so this thing that we've talked about before with point and click adventures, where a lot of times it feels like you take this item that have nothing to do with each other and you combine them to make some bizarre doodad that you can use to solve the puzzle. You know, that doesn't happen because these guys are in a really gritty, real scenario in which they just, you know, you're just looking for something sharp that you can stab into this dude's face.
Yeah, I mean, their whole life is a puzzle to solve, effectively, just to survive, right?
Exactly, yeah. They're always resource limited. You've always got these really high tensions between the humans, you know, because they're really stressed out and they haven't slept and they don't have anything to eat. And so they start going at each other. And it's really, really good stuff. And the other thing I really like about it is, and one reason I don't play a lot of zombie games is because the style of them can get really old to me, you know, the really kind of dark, gritty, dusty kind of style that you get a lot of times, the lame sound effects and everything. And what I really like about this is, for one thing, the audio design is primarily people talking to each other and having arguments and coming to grips with their situation. It's not a bunch of zombie moans and stuff like that. But also the graphical design is based on the comic book. And I have a couple of the graphic novels, and it looks almost exactly like the art style from those graphic novels. And it's essentially cel shaded, but it looks so good. And it really, really, really works with the story. So I was incredibly pleased with this game. And I wouldn't have played, I haven't played any of the Back to the Future. I haven't played anything from Telltale in a long time. And the only reason I went to this is because I heard such amazing reviews of it everywhere. Everybody was loving it. And I loved it just as much. So yeah, I would definitely recommend it if you can play this. Well, that's all I've got, John. What about you?
All right. Well, you know, the big release this week has been Diablo 3, and I partaked. I mentioned a couple weeks ago. I was in the beta that they had a stress test, so anybody could play it. So I downloaded the client, and I was actually pleasantly surprised at how much I liked it. You know, I've always heard so much. This is kind of one of those iconic games, Diablo 2, especially. Kind of skeptical whether or not it would be, you know, as good as everybody said. So yeah, so, you know, I picked it up and I'm liking it so far. I mean, if I was to compare it to something, I would say it's like probably old school Gauntlet. You know, you crawl through these areas, these kind of spooky areas kind of thing with a friend. I think you can have a party that's up to four people in size. But yeah, and rumor has it it's coming out for consoles, so it'd be interesting, you know, kind of what they do. I mean, it would be perfect for Wii U with a pointer because, I mean, it's all mouse clicks.
The pointer, but also the having the touchscreen on the controller seems like really nice for like navigating the kind of thick menus that you get in this kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, and the menus, I mean, there's not many of them, but it would actually be useful because you get loot constantly. Everything drops loot, you know, shields and swords and, you know, which is good because you want to sell it and make money, but also, like, you know, sometimes it's just like, God, I have to sit here and manage. You know, the first thing you do anytime you go back to New Tristram, which is the main town, you just head straight to sell all your gear. Just sell it off. So I could see that. That would actually probably be pretty useful because, I mean, your main things are your inventory, your skills, and just kind of like selling your inventory. So it could be quite helpful to have the Wii U, you know, screen, the extra screen there to do that with. You know, in terms of actual gameplay, you know, you have five different classes: Demon Hunter, Wizard, Monk, Witch Doctor, and Barbarian. I know a lot of people that have played Diablo 2, and they're kind of like, yeah, the characters are sort of, they're all kind of more, they're more alike than they are different this time around. So, but yeah, you know, there's plenty of lore, lots of great voice acting in it, you know, and what I liked about it is the fact that they didn't, even though they could have said, well, you know, it's been 12 years since the last game came out, so we're going to make everything 3D, every cutscene is going to be 3D. They didn't go that route, and I think that's because they wanted it to really work well across a range of different machines. Like, you know, I've often complained about how bad my PC is, and it actually plays fairly well on it. They've done a good job of making the engine, you know, detailed, but not necessarily too detailed. Like, it looks kind of the same across a lot of machines. And, you know, and any, like, when you talk to other characters, it's all in text boxes. It's not overly, you know, they don't have to 3D-ize everything that you do. So it's kind of old school in that respect, which really is kind of nice these days. You know, they didn't feel the need to, you know, kind of go overboard graphically with it, even though it is a nice looking game.
Well, John, having played some Diablo 3 now,
yep.
Yeah, you didn't have that experience back at PAX East. And one of the games that you played and talked about a little bit was Heroes of Ruin. Mm-hmm. Now, on the surface, these seem to be very similar experiences from what I can tell. And mainly because I have this sort of triangulated point of reference, which is one you mentioned over email, but Gauntlet Legends is a game that I played the shit out of on N64.
Yep.
Both by myself and with people over. And to me, Heroes of Ruin harkens to that quite a bit. And that's one of the reasons that I'm really interested in it. But Diablo 3 also looks, you know, quite a bit like it. So what do you think? Does this make you more excited for Heroes of Ruin, or do you think they're actually more different than I'm thinking?
I think they're very similar. I mean, I think certainly Heroes of Ruin, you know, is kind of a takeoff on the Diablo concept. The big thing that I can see is with Heroes of Ruin, it'll be interesting. The one thing they haven't talked about very much, but they mentioned it at PAX East, was voiceover IP.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing I'm curious about. They, you know, they talked about, you know, yeah, it's going to have voiceover IP, but they didn't really go into exactly how that was going to work. You know, they claimed that it worked pretty well, but it'll be interesting to see. So I think that would be really, really key, because I don't really think that Heroes of Ruin would be difficult to really get into, especially with a group, without having voiceover IP. So
absolutely.
It'll be interesting to see how well that works. If it works very well, then I think it'll be a great game.
Yeah, I'm excited about that feature. And they mentioned at the I think it was at the Street Pass panel, and they mentioned that you actually don't even have to have someone's friend code. Like, you don't even have to be 3DS friends with them in order to voice chat with them. And I'm thinking, wow, Nintendo has gotten really, really lax in their old age.
Yeah. Well, and that's key in this type of game too, because that's the thing. I mean, you know, you'll have people, you know, on your friends list. They may be online, they may not, but it's the kind of game, Diablo 3, that where it's very easy to jump into somebody else's game. I mean, it encourages that. I mean, because, I mean, immediately if there's somebody online that you've grouped with before, it'll show as soon as you log on, before you even jump into game, it'll say, hey, this person is online. Do you want to jump into their game? So you can just hop right in. What I'm hoping to see from Heroes of Ruin is that kind of, like, just being able to jump right into somebody else's game. See that they're online, see where they are, and then hop into the game if you feel so inclined. Because if you can see that, if they really utilize that well, it'll be really, really good. Because, right, you know, it'll be instant. You just hop online and see what's out there, what's going on, and then just get into somebody else's game and maybe do something, maybe go back and, you know, clear out an area that you hadn't completely cleared before. So it could be really, really good.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's very appealing to me because, you know, I'm not really a big online gamer. This is the kind of game that I might want to play online because the interaction is rich. You know, that's one of my problems with Mario Kart 7. And I've talked about this a bunch on the show before, but because in Mario Kart 7, the amount of creativity in how you play the game is very narrow. You're going forward basically, and you don't choose the items that you get. They're random. So it's hard to tell one person from another. You can certainly tell a human player from a computer player.
Yeah.
But you can't necessarily tell one person from another based on how they play the game. And it's one reason that I don't think anyone's ever made a big stink about online voice chat for Mario Kart, because why? There's really no strategy. There's no teamwork. There's just no reason other than just shit talking. And that's not really something Nintendo wants to promote. But with Heroes of Ruin, it's cooperative. You have these small teams. You have things that you can only do together. And you have totally different characters whose abilities complement each other. And to me, that is exact. I mean, you guys were even, you and Alex were even talking to each other to get through, things even over local play, back at that Square event at PAX East. And being able to do that online to me would be really key to having a good experience with it. And that's the kind of game that I want to play online, because it's just the level of interaction is so much better. And doing something cooperatively is a lot more fun than competitively to me. And that's an experience, especially co-op, that co-op has never really been done very much on Nintendo platforms at all.
Yeah. And I mean, in these types of games, I mean, it's just huge to be able to say, okay, well, we've already gone down that area. Or even like when you split up for a second, you can say, yeah, there isn't anything down here. You know, just being able to talk to each other and kind of say, okay, well, or say if somebody's already gone through the area, they'll say, okay, well, you know, this boss does this, so you need to get over there and just keep shooting, and I'll run up to him and kind of, you know, draw him away from you.
Do you like that, though? Because, like, that's one of my problems with these kinds of games. Like, I've played Titan's Quest, which is a Diablo clone, and I've played Borderlands, which is basically a first-person Diablo. I mean, with all the loot and stuff, and the levels, and I have, like, my problem was I had a friend with way much more time on his hands than I did, and he would just, like, play ahead and level up his character and become overpowered.
Yeah.
And then I would try to join his game, and I would, you know, like, I was not strong enough, and he would join my game, and he would just kill everything, and, like, that was not much fun for me. And also, like, he already had seen all the, you know, he could warn me beforehand, oh, okay, there's a bus coming up, prepare yourself, and this is how you beat it. So, I don't know, like, I really enjoy my single-player games. I like discovering them at my own pace and everything. And,
me too,
That's something that I can't get when I'm playing with certain people. So, I guess, you know, I could try to get better friends, but,
well,
I mean...
Yeah, I mean, and I'm actually kind of dealing with that right now, because I'm playing through it with a friend of mine from work, and you know, obviously, you know, I'm not able to play tonight because I'm recording this podcast, and so he's like, well, you know, should I go online? Should I play ahead? And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, maybe you want to start a separate character and maybe just play through the opening areas again, and you know, so you kind of run into that, right? And that's, you know, that's one of the drawbacks, is that you kind of have to, you just sort of have to, you know, throttle back yourself so that you don't go ahead if you're playing through with somebody. So, but, you know, I don't mind that. I'm kind of used to the whole sort of somebody knowing more about, say, a certain boss, just, and that's like from, you know, from games like World of Warcraft, where you have to cooperate to beat bosses. So somebody knowing something about the boss before you go into it actually helps you, because otherwise you don't know what the hell you're doing. So, you know, now it's not quite the same in Diablo, just because the, you know, you don't have to strategize as much. But I'm kind of used to that. But what I don't want story spoilers. So that's the kind of stuff that I want to take at my own pace. So I have to kind of watch that when I'm playing with somebody else, that they don't kind of spoil things for me. So,
right.
But it kind of goes with the territory. So you kind of have to gauge that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I just kind of like to just play by myself. So
yeah, I think it's a big advantage for games that have separate co-op modes.
Yeah.
So that you, the story is not in the co-op. Those are two totally different things. And so when you play co-op, you don't have to worry about spoilers and being sort of out of place, out of time, you know, being shoved into a part of the game that you're not really ready for yet. That's, you know, one of my favorite things about Portal 2, and John and I way back when did some of that in Modern Warfare 2 and that Spec Ops mode. And I thought that stuff works really well. I'm not as big of a fan of cooperative story modes because of all the problems you just mentioned. And I don't know that anyone's come up with a really good solution to that yet, but I feel like that's on the horizon. I feel like somebody's got to be thinking about this. How do we deal with this, you know? And I don't know, maybe we'll see it pretty soon.
But yeah, I mean, it's, I'm happy with it so far, so it's, you know, it's good. So, I mean, there's so many people, you have to understand, so many people are playing this game, which is kind of that's part of the appeal, right? The game is meant to be played in groups.
Sure.
A ton of people own this game, so, you know, it's, you would probably have more fun with it. The chances of you having more fun with it with a group, it's pretty high. You have a pretty good chance of that happening, right?
Yeah.
I find that, you know, even looking back all the games I've played, it's typically not the game itself is really not as important as the people that you play it with. I mean, you know, it could be Brawl, it could be any other game. It's not the fact that you're playing necessarily Brawl. It's the fact that you're playing it with other people that makes it fun. So,
well, I refuse to cede to peer pressure personally.
I kind of disagree with that philosophy. Not saying that you're wrong, but I just don't enjoy games in that way. Because I'm more on Guillaume's side of, you know, I prefer single player games. I will occasionally play multiplayer stuff, but for me, it's more about the game. If the game is really fun and I think there's something about it that would be different and even more fun in multiplayer, then I will try the multiplayer mode. But if the single player game isn't fun, it's very rare that I'll buy a game. Smash Brothers is pretty much the only example of that.
Yeah, see, this probably explains why I've gravitated away from some of the Super Mario games. Yeah, really, it does, because that experience really has not, it's not as rewarding to me as playing with other people and having a good time that way.
Very, very interesting stuff. Okay, so Guillaume, it's your chance to wrap up new business for the first time, sort of.
Well, last week I've been, you know, like sometimes at work, I take some shifts on Fridays. Like we take turns having a shift instead of 9 to 5, we work from noon to 8. So last Friday morning, I go to work and I realize I have no emails and I'm like, oh shit, I wasn't supposed to come to work until like 3 hours from now. So now I'm stuck downtown and I'm not really feeling like shopping or anything like that. So I just take my 3DS and like it's basically the first time I believe, like I'm not used to bringing my handheld at work. I've only started doing that since the StreetPass thing. And so like it's the very first time that StreetPass has benefited me in a way other than giving me StreetPasses. I'm just like, oh, great. Like, I don't have to play, you know, like Twitter on my iPhone for 3 hours. I can just like actually play Legend of Zelda. So that's what I did. I played Link's Awakening. I had put it down last year, like maybe a month after it came out. Like, I got pretty far into it. I got to Dungeon 7 and I stopped playing because I know that game by like the back of my hand. Like, I had that game growing up and I played it. I played through it maybe a dozen times. So, jeez, like, it's definitely nothing new. So, you know, like, that was a good, enjoyable way to spend 3 hours. I don't really have anything new to say about the game. I mean, if you haven't played it, yet, do play it now. I mean, like, it's easily.
Yes, like now.
Yeah, it's easily available and it still holds up, in my opinion. Like, it's still, maybe some of the, sometimes, like, where to go, it's a little bit obscure, a little bit obtuse.
Yes, I agree with that. As someone who doesn't know the game, like, the back of my hand, when I played it on 3DS, last year, almost a year ago, when they launched it over E3, I think it was only the second time I'd ever played it. And, there were definitely a couple points where I was like, where the hell am I supposed to go? Like the game just gives you almost no clues. And sometimes there'll be like certain squares on the map that are really difficult to get to. Like you have to kind of go around this really crazy circuitous route, you know, jumping over a bunch of stuff and switching out items. And I think that's my one complaint about Link's Awakening, although it's a great game. But sometimes just like getting from one place to another involves you switching out items about 8 times. And when you know where you're trying to go and you just want to get there, it becomes really kind of tedious to travel because there's so many steps involved. You're constantly pausing and going to the menu and switching things out just to go from one place to another.
Right. And even myself, like I still feel my way around the game sometimes. I'm just like, okay, like where am I supposed to go now? And I get to a place and I'm like, shit, I need the hookshot here. And so I travel back and I try to find my way, you know, some other way to get to my goal.
See, to me, I like that, though. To me, that's a little bit more old school rather than, I mean, I feel like a lot of those games nowadays, you're sort of handheld through stuff. Like it's very obvious how to get through stuff.
Oh, I love the figuring out process.
Yeah.
I don't love the fact that it's a Game Boy game and you can only hold one item at a time and there's about 8 items in the game and you're constantly having to switch back and forth among them. And the whole process just takes about 3 seconds longer than it should.
I'm pretty forgiving of that. And you can hold 2 items. I mean, you don't need your sword all the time.
Well, that's true. Yes. But sometimes you need a certain combination. So even if you've already got one of the correct items out, you still have to go switch.
That happens mostly in the dungeons and maybe like 1 or 2 areas on the world map. So I don't think it's too bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a good way to pass 3 hours and I was glad I didn't have to play like some iPhone game instead. or even like Pushmo and stuff. Like I have a kind of a low tolerance for playing those kinds of games for a long period of time. So it's good to have that game all the time on my 3DS and having the 3DS on me all the time because of StreetPass.
Hey.
So I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
But then later that day, there was like some sort of emergency, and I had to close my 3DS, and it had been a while since I had played a Game Boy game on that thing. And it had been a while since I played the 3DS, actually. So I completely forgot that when you press the power button, you don't get your save state. It just interrupts everything, and you can't go back to your game. And so I was like at the 8th dungeon at that point. Well, you know, too bad. Save state gone. And so I check, like, in that game, it's so impossible in the 3DS to save your game. You have to press select, start, and B at the same time. You can't do that while gripping the 3DS normally. You would need, like, a third hand.
You could also die and get a game over.
Sure, but when you've played through the game a dozen times, you don't die very often. Yeah, so 8th dungeon, and then, whoops, I realize my mistake. And I go check my last actual save in the game. There were only like 4 hearts on my save file. And I was like, fuck. So
playing it through that 13th.
Yeah, well, pretty much, actually. I am already at the 5th dungeon now. So since I had, you know, like quit the game last year, like it's not that fresh enough in my mind that I'm kind of tired of it. So I was like, oh, okay, you know what? I'll just keep playing. And because, you know, I played it so often, like, it wasn't such a big deal, but I'm still, you know, completely, like, is it really impossible for Nintendo to patch this? Because it seems like a big problem to me. Like, the power button is so easy to accidentally set off, and, like, just losing all your progress like this, like, there's no reason in my mind that you can't just go back to your game like you would after pressing the menu button.
Is that the problem, that you accidentally pressed the power button?
Well, no, I, you know, deliberately pressed it.
Okay, that's your problem, because there's no reason to ever push the power button on the 3DS. Just close it.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not the only thing I've been playing. There have been some new Club Nintendo free games on offer on tap. So I've been playing this overlooked gem by Intelligent Systems, you know, the makers of Advance Wars and Fire Emblem and Tetris Attack,
Paper Mario,
you know, Paper Mario. So from the creators of all those epics, Echo Shooter on WiiWare, a light gun game where you shoot cans.
Wow.
The planet.
Strange.
Yeah. The planet has been overtaken by evil aliens, the canoids. And you're playing like the smiling construction worker who apparently is the only one with a weapon to take care of the canoids. You just go around and you shoot cans and different enemies made of cans. And by different enemies, I mean like 4 or 5 types. You know, like there's like some sort of insect canoids, and there's like robot looking bundles of cans. And that's pretty much all you do. Like, I don't understand who approved this and who had the idea in the first place. It's almost as if, like, someone had thought, like, oh, you know what's really fun when you've got, like, you know, a shooting range or a gun or something? Shooting at cans. Let's make a whole game out of it. But then they forgot that, you know, like, the reason why it's so fun, it's because, you know, you're shooting a gun. when you're just like holding a Wii remote and you're just moving a pointer around and you're shooting cans that are not really, like, you don't get like that feedback, like you don't get the satisfying thunk or anything like that. It's such a pointless waste of time.
So this is sad, because the games that are offered up on Club Nintendo to download are supposedly chosen based on like really positive user comments from people who actually bought it. Like, these are survey comments that they collected through Club Nintendo, and that's how they curate the services. They try to find these sort of overlooked gems that a few people really, really love, and then sort of allow a larger audience to check it out. And I'd say for the most part, the selections that they've offered have been things that you can see why, you know, even if it's not a game that you love, you play it and you can see why a few people would go really crazy over it and would give it like really high recommendations. But it doesn't sound like you saw that in Echo Shooter.
No. Like, there's no, the shooting the cans themselves is not really satisfying. And I mean, like, you would have a better time, you know, in that mini game in Metroid Prime Corruption, where you shoot you know, that kind of can-looking thing in the air, and you try to keep it in the air as long as you can. Because there is some sort of, like, that kind of gameplay in this game, but the physics aren't there. Like, the cans always, like, pop straight up, and then you can get more points by shooting them again, but there's really nothing satisfying about it.
Hmm. It seems like it's something that they probably had as an experiment laying around and decided to make some money off of it.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. Like, it really feels like someone had, like, this bright idea, no one stopped him, and then someone gave him, like just enough budget to create the game, and then inexplicably more budget to try to make it a little bit fancier. Like, there's weird little touches. Like, the game has a jingle when you select the game, like, in the Wii channels. For some reason, they hired this woman to sing, like, Echo Shooter. For like, it's completely pointless. Like, I don't get it. And also, like, you know, like, they designed a character for you to identify as. I don't know. Like, you see him during the credits. He's walking towards you with his gun and, you know, smiling. And, like, his belly jiggles. Like, it's got, like, belly physics.
And wow.
Tech demo.
I really don't get it. And the game is only like 3 levels long, not that you wouldn't want it to last any longer. Once you finish those, then you've got like the hardcore mode or whatever it's called. And, you know, predictably enough, it's just the 3 levels, you know, one after the other. I don't know. I really don't recommend it. Like, whatever it is that you're looking for in a game, in a light gun shooter, like, you're going to find something way better in bargain bins pretty much anywhere. I've been pretty much keeping up with WiiWare until the end, and I bought everything that looked interesting to me, so I was probably, like, the only person in the world excited about this Club Nintendo release, because, you know, this was one of the few games from Nintendo I had not looked at. But, yeah, it's pretty disappointing. And I've played another game, also from Club Nintendo for free, by our friends at Skip, actually.
Mm.
Snowpack Park. This kind of Pikmin Animal Crossing-esque game where you basically herd penguins. There's, like, after, like, the intro where you have the least graphically impressive snowstorm ever, basically you come out of your tent and you're trying to herd some penguins, you have to go find them, and the whole game is about finding fish to feed them and trying to befriend them, basically. You can go different areas, and the whole goal is to try to get them under this big trap. You've got a timer and you're trying to get the penguins in there. And, so like you pet them and you feed them and,
sounds kind of evil, actually. You try to gain their trust so you can trap them and imprison them.
There's actually a mod where that replaces all the penguins with little children.
The penguins are cute, though, and I don't know. Like, the game is weirdly charming. I've really just scratched the surface. Once you've captured some penguins, you know, you've got to keep them happy. You can play mini games with them. They're very basic, but they're so goofy that, you know, like, they're fun to try at least once. For instance, like, I've played basketball with penguins, and when I say I played basketball with penguins, I mean I grabbed my penguins and I tried to shoot them in a basketball net. And I don't know, somehow that gains you friendship points with the penguins, and then you can unlock more mini games and more areas. And I don't know, like, I feel like if you want a you know, cute little game that you can play just for a couple of minutes every day, you could probably do worse. And also, like, it's 150 points instead of Echo Shooter's 200 points on Club Nintendo. So it's a better value. It's a longer game. And after I've described it, you probably already know whether or not you're interested. If you are, go for it.
Yeah, I'm gonna do. I decided after hearing your ringing endorsement of this game, I'm gonna track kind of like the way you endorse things. Is this you know, you could do worse. You know, the Guillaume back of the box index to see how back of the box worthy your assessments of various games are.
All right. Well, like, if there's one thing you need to know about me, it's that I'm never really comfortable recommending things.
I can tell. I know. The few times you've done that, you've been like, you know, if you had something to do on a night where, you know, no one was around, you could
okay,
probably
but
do worse,
like,
than this.
You know, like, I've been downloading WiiWare like crazy, and, like, not everyone has been like that, you know? Like, people usually have more Or more discerning, let's just say.
Yeah, clearly you have low standards if you're still keeping up with WiiWare at this point.
Yeah, but at the same time, you don't just sit there and blindly like say, hey, this is pretty good, or this is okay, or whatever.
Yeah,
you're typically like, yeah, don't play this game. It's a complete waste of time. I have no idea why I bought it. I'm an idiot for wasting my money on it. But
technically, he didn't buy it. He only used coins that are... just think about how many surveys you filled out in order to get Echo Shooter.
That's true.
It was all worth it.
Yeah.
But really, like, to me, like, if a game is kind of interesting looking and if it's adequately priced, yeah, sure, I'll download it.
I'm always up for interesting failures. I don't know how interesting Echo Shooter sounds, but...
Johnny, back in the box. This game is an interesting failure. Jonathan Metzner's had to run for it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's like better skip games that I would recommend before, like any of the art style games for sure.
Or Chibi Robo.
But yeah, or Chibi Robo, of course. Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a little bit of Chibi Robo DNA in this game, to be honest.
Oh, okay. Actually, that's the most interesting thing you've said about it. Okay, well, that totally changes my perspective now.
Anyway, I won't talk more about it. I haven't unlocked every area or anything. I do plan to keep on playing it. So, you know, that says something.
Sure. Already. Yeah, okay. No, that sounds pretty good. All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business for us. We're going to take a quick break, do some now playing, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week on Now Playing, we start off with a review of Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy by Danny Bivens in Japan. He says, ride your chocobo down memory lane. Let me see you ride that chocobo.
Yeah, not that choco.
We've also got an interview with Supervillain Studios. They're the developer of Order Up, and they speak on the retail and digital scenes and their experience working with Nintendo. That game's coming out, I think, later in the summer. It was a retail game in Europe, and now it's going to be coming out in North America on the eShop. So they've had a kind of interesting experience going back and forth between retail and digital. And we've got a feature called What the GBA Ambassador Games Could Tell Us About Nintendo's Future. The 10 games that went out to loyal customers might hint at the future or not, but hopefully they do.
Wow, that really, that's a lot of commitment there.
No waffling whatsoever. All right, Alex Gulafi brings us a preview of Pokédex 3D Pro, and it's the eShop launch title is getting a brand new coat of paint.
And a brand new price.
And also, we have a feature, the Wii U Rumor Roundup by none other than our forum denizen, Black and Mild.
And the greatest Swapnote user of all time.
Yes, prolific. One of our crack forum posters lays out a whole mess of Wii U rumors for all y'all. And we also have Neil Ronahan bringing us impressions of Rayman Origins. It's the same great game in nice-looking 3D, but the controls are terrible, according to Neil.
There's a demo of that on the eShop now, so you can try the terrible controls for yourself.
But I gotta say, like, it's an amazing game. Go get it if you've got another platform.
I'm waiting for my Vita.
People are definitely happy with that version, so yeah. Go get that. We've got a preview, Pokemon Dream Radar by Alex Gulafi. The DS sequels get some needed 3DS functionality. We've got an Extra Life, Super Battleship on the SNES by Alex Gulafi and James Dawson. Does this interpretation of the classic game float or sink?
Timely!
Yeah, just in time for the future Hollywood flop. And feature, the Japan eShop Roundup for the 16th of May by Danny Bivens. Learn how to play tennis and then relax on a boat ride in the rivers of Tokyo.
That sounds wonderful.
It sounds wonderful. Mm. Much like his life, Danny Bivens' life.
Is that must be what his life is like.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, just another day.
Okay, so be sure to head over to NintendoWorldReport.com to check out all of this original content, plus the latest news, screenshots, videos, podcastuses, etc. right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we are back for part two of the show. Before we get into listener mail, I thought it would be fun to play a little bit of getting to know you with Guillaume. And James will probably have a couple things that he wants to ask you when he gets back next week. But I've got a sort of a list of sort of lightning round questions. Just, you know, it's tough because the three of us, John and James and I, already know each other really well. And also the audience already knows us really well from being on the show for a long time. And so you're kind of jumping into this, Guillaume, as more of an unknown, even more than Greg was probably. And so I thought it'd be nice to, you know, try to catch up a little bit and just give people a little bit of a base of reference.
Yeah, get the awkward first date out of the way.
Exactly. This whole episode's awkward. So it's just, this is the tough part.
Guillaume, I will kiss you goodnight, but no tongue.
It gets easier from here. Yeah. First off, obviously, Guillaume, you live in Quebec, Canada, and so I thought it'd be interesting to hear about when did you first learn English, or when did you start to learn English?
Well, you know, I'm sure that school played some part in it, but but yeah, like I basically started really reading it actually through getting Final Fantasy Legend 2 on the Game Boy.
That's funny. That's awesome.
This worked out great.
like one of my friends, he told me about his older cousin whom he idolized, you know, and like, oh, my older cousin, like he's so into this game, Final Fantasy. You should ask that for Christmas. So I did. And I got that thing that I couldn't understand. And I was like, you know, like, what the hell did you make me ask? Like, what did I waste my present for? Like, I must have been like 10 or 12. I can't remember. But then, you know, eventually, you know, you're in front of a video game, you want to play it. So I just grabbed an English-French dictionary and I tried to get by as much as I could. And that game has such an esoteric story. Like, it's really, really weird. And like, you fight off like Greek gods and, you know, you're assisted by Odin. And like, it's really, really weird. And
isn't there a lot of stuff about the Magi?
Yeah.
Okay. I remember reading about Final Fantasy Legend 2 in Nintendo Power, and I thought it looked really cool, and I didn't have a Game Boy, so I couldn't play it. And to this day, I've never played that game. And it's sort of very close to the top of my list of games that I hope will come to the 3DS Virtual Console, because I still really want to play it.
Yeah, and I am so devastated that we never got the remake Saga 2 that came out in Japan for the DS.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Yeah, Saga 2 and 3 have both been remade, and
wow.
You can go check like the Japanese website. They've got like a beautiful remake of the music, and sometimes I put that on and I just start weeping softly.
manly fashion.
Oh, absolutely, wow. Yeah.
We might have learned a little bit too much about you with this question.
But yeah, so like, you know, like video games helped out for the reading part. But then, yeah, like decades later, like I never got really an opportunity to speak English very much until I got to college. And I went to an English college, and then I was in residence with international students. And so like, you know, like really immersion. So that's where I learned to lose a little bit of my accent, although not all of it. And yeah, it shaped who I am today.
So you specifically went to college, part of it, obviously, to learn English then. It was one of your goals.
We won't get into that too much. But yeah, I was like pretty much everyone, I'm sure, I was pretty confused getting into college. And yeah, I went into English studies, actually, English literature.
Well, okay. That's the thing. It's the same in Canada. It's the same thing. You know, you can go into colleges specifically learn how to speak French, like to immerse yourself in the French culture.
Yeah, this is probably a good opportunity to ask you, John, growing up in Toronto, how much French did you learn?
I pretty much knew that I was pretty terrible at speaking French, so I abandoned that.
Like most Ontarians? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in high school, taking French classes was mandatory, I believe, until grade 10, I think. And then after that, you could choose to kind of go the, you know, the French speaking route. Like you could continue to take those courses. And if you wanted to, like, you know, like Guillaume did, kind of go into college, you know, specifically with a goal of learning French and French.
I take it you took the liberation path of never studying French again.
That is correct. Just because I knew, just kind of like from my interests, just the way my life was going, I just knew that I wouldn't really have much of a use for French. And it turned out I was right. I mean, I moved to the U.S. I mean, to me, I knew very early on in my life that I would probably benefit more from either learning like something like Spanish or Japanese, either of which I learned, but.
But it was a nice thought.
It sounded good at the time when I was 8 years old, so whatever. Right.
Very interesting.
You were 8 years old. You already knew you were getting out of that country.
I was like, I'm in high school. I'm like, I'm never gonna use French. Even though it did help me read the back of cereal boxes, I will say that.
Very nice. Okay, so Guillaume, next question. When did you discover Nintendo?
Well, pretty much like most kids, I'm sure, I discovered it at a friend's house. I didn't have an NES when growing up. But yeah, like I played at a friend's, and of course I loved Super Mario and everything. That friend actually, like his dad owned a grocery store where you could rent out games. And so he could basically rent out all of the games for free. And so I got to experience a lot of NES games that way. And then eventually my parents gave me a Game Boy, really confirming my suspicions that they just really wanted the TV for themselves. And so I, you know, like that's basically what I grew up with. And that's why I've played Zelda a dozen times. And that shaped the man that I am today.
Wonderful. It's perfect.
So what's your experience discussing video games? Obviously, that's what you're here to do primarily, other than edit the audio. So how did you come to this? I mean, you were on the Negative World podcast, and before that, message boards?
Yeah, I never, you know, like you guys can really get into the details of gameplay and analyze because you've really, like, you've put time and effort into reviews, and you've been edited, and you've learned, like, tricks of the trade and everything. Whereas I come more from the streets, from the IG.
That's awesome.
I grew up, you know, on the IGN boards where, you know, like people weren't nice and basically where you won arguments by not listening to what the other person was saying and just...
You had to fight to survive.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, like, no, I discovered message boards eventually. Actually, like, IGN, I actually went there first to talk about DVDs, about movies. And so, like, it was weird. Like, I had gotten away from video games a little bit, like, during the N64 period, because I, you know, I couldn't afford one, and I was in college, and I was far away from pretty much anyone who owned one. And the games didn't really seem that interesting to me from afar. And I was busy playing games like Fallout or, you know, PC games of the time, StarCraft. But yeah, so I wanted to discuss movies, and eventually... Like the chaos that was the GameCube general board, it was so fast moving, and everyone was always...
Those were good times. Yeah, I remember that.
Everyone was always bickering and always like fights against trolls, and I don't know. Like eventually, I got roped up in that, and I, you know, like I had heard that Metroid Prime was coming out for the GameCube, and all of a sudden, you know, I was just like, oh shit! Now I gotta get one, and. You know, I got back into Nintendo that way. And, yeah, like the boards were addictive that way. But eventually it wasn't so new anymore. It got a little bit tiring of always having the same arguments about the kitty purple lunchbox and everything. just when everyone was just reaching their, like all the regulars there were reaching their saturation point. Like, yeah, they couldn't take it anymore. Someone suggested, oh, okay, well, you know, I've got this site, Negative World, let's just all move there. And people actually did. And so, like, the good community just moved away from IGN to Negative World. And I've really put a lot of effort and time into those forums. And eventually, you know, like, Johnny, like, you've sometimes said about, talked about how this podcast allowed you to talk about Nintendo and like all the nitty gritty details. And you can't get those conversations in real life. And, that sounded good to me. Like I felt I was in the same situation. And at the time also, Steven, my friend who also co-started the Negative World podcast, had started the podcast with someone else. And so I bugged him, and I was just like, oh, okay, well, now that I can, I see someone can do this, I'm going to get in on this. I got to try it out, and I got to bug him to show me how and everything. So yeah, started the podcast, and it was a learning experience, but it was a lot of fun being able to finally talk for real, you know, hear the voice of all those people that I had been talking to virtually for years, really.
I think you're the first person to ever come and be a part of Radio Free Nintendo who had actually been on another podcast before.
Hmm.
So you're, you know, in a funny way, you're probably the most experienced person that we have, that we've ever had, really.
Well,
just trust me, just leave it there.
Yeah. Just thank you.
Yeah. All right. So, this is a really key question our audience will want to know, because we can judge you so much based on this. What are some of your favorite games ever?
Well, you know, Halo and Call of Duty and, no.
You too?
Those are legitimate answers, but I don't believe them.
He actually could be trolling me with that answer, by the way.
Yeah, it's not. I was kidding. I really don't care much about first-person shooters. Even when I was in my PC phase, I was, you know, gravitating more towards stuff like Free Space or Alpha Centauri. Really, well, games that don't exist anymore. But yeah, on the on your NeoGAF thread, I've already been pigeonholed as the platformer lover, and I'm fine with that. I I do like some 2D platforming and 3D ones as well. Like these days, I definitely am more into retro games than I am about whatever new stuff is coming out. I've been, you know, going through Castlevania and Ninja Gaiden and games that I never thought I would ever finish, and I've actually been, you know, going back and finishing them since I never owned an NES when I was a child, and I really, really still enjoy them. It's more where my affinity lies. Yeah, and some of my favorite games, I grew up playing the Game Boy, so obviously like those games really, Wario Land and Final Fantasy Legend 2 and stuff like that.
Link's Awakening, sounds like.
Absolutely. And on the Super NES, actually, I was one of the few lucky people who had somehow discovered Demon's Crest back in the day.
Nice. What's up, dude?
Since then, like, well, I've sold my entire collection stupidly, but still. Oh. Like, I played that game back in the day. Like, that was definitely one of my favorites. And yeah, like Chrono Trigger and all of that good stuff. And currently, I still like Nintendo games a ton. Like, I can't get enough of Super Mario Galaxy. And, yeah, sure, like Super Mario 3D Land and Donkey Kong Country Returns. Yeah, just give me more.
So you're pretty excited for new Super Mario Brothers 2.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But I'll definitely still play it, you know, day one. That's for sure.
Sure. We all will, of course. Yep. Okay, have you ever wanted to develop games?
No, I basically, editing, hosting a podcast is probably the most creative thing I've ever done in my life. And I never had really any ambitions to make games. I wouldn't know where to start. I think I've got a pretty good grasp on, you know, what makes good gameplay, or, you know, what is good design. Like, I, you know, I think I recognize it when I see it, but from there to just being able to reproduce it, I don't know.
Yeah, those are two very different things.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair enough. I'm with you, man. I'm with you.
So yeah, I'm one of those who criticize, not one of those who actually do things.
Well, you're in good company then.
Yep.
Wait until James gets back. Jeez.
Yeah.
What are your interests other than gaming?
It's pretty sad. I feel like, well, like somehow, you know, like I got away from video games for a while, but then I got back into them and like really hard, you know, and I feel like video games took more and more of my free time, like video games and Negative World. Like I've started, you know, a lot of things over there, and I was really, really involved in that community. And so, like, I used to read more. I don't read so much anymore. I was really into movies. That's how I got onto IGN. And I still enjoy, you know, like, watching old classics and or new stuff. Like, I'm really... I do still enjoy movies, but I'm not into them as much as back when I was like checking Box Office Mojo every day and like Rotten Tomatoes and and other than that, like, no, like I bike a lot. I bike everywhere.
That's cool.
And I'm not really into organized sports at all. So I'm sorry. You won't hear me, you know, rage against Belichick or whatever his name is.
And not the Canadiens either?
No. Sorry.
Not a hockey fan?
I couldn't name you even like a single player.
We'll work on that. We'll work on it. We got time. We got time.
Yeah, John's not very comfortable with that situation.
Yeah, we got time. It's a work in progress.
And along that line of reasoning, my final question, what's your favorite style of poutine?
Oh, wow. Nothing beats bacon and onion on pizza or on poutine or on whatever it is that you're eating. Bacon and onion, amazing.
That sounds pretty good.
I eat so much poutine right now. Wow.
Don't get it anywhere, though. Like, don't get it at, like, Disneyland. Somehow they've got poutine on their menu. don't eat it there.
Is that it? Do they have it at Epcot?
I think so. What,
that's like, where not surprising.
I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go to Epcot, what you see of Canada at Epcot will be, that's kind of warped to say the least.
Mounties and Paul Gross,
you know,
and
lumberjacks wearing flannel. Everything is apparently made of logs in Canada.
Bonhomme, of course.
Yeah, of course, Bonhomme. Yeah, it's kind of a weird mix of Canada in about 1975 mixed with like, you know, Courier de Bois and like, you know, the gold rush days or something. It's very strange, very weird.
Yeah, well, I don't know if the listeners even know what poutine is, but I've become fairly obsessed with it lately, especially after I went to Toronto a few weeks ago and had it a couple times there. I haven't had it with bacon and onions. That sounds very good. So, and yeah, poutine is maybe the only authentically Canadian dish. And, it's like a snack food or a street food. It's French fries with gravy and cheese curds. And it is awesome.
Especially like when you're drunk or, you know,
yeah.
Yes.
And really, really hungry late at night. There's
it's like
nothing
Canadian nachos.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it's freaking awesome. Okay, so that thus concludes our little interview with Guillaume. Thanks for playing along there, man.
Yeah, now people know everything about me.
That's right.
Everything.
He's a simple man.
Yeah.
Now we're going to do listener mail and ask the questions that you actually care about. And the address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. The first email this week comes from Jet Pilot. And he writes, what are your thoughts on Nintendo's recent trend of selling exclusivity rights to GameStop for various releases such as the Circle Pad Pro, Xenoblade Chronicles, and Kid Icarus 3D Classics? I, like Zach Miller on Connectivity, do not shop at GameStop. I don't like this recent trend of Nintendo selling exclusivity rights to one retailer. Yes, you can get the Circle Pad Pro from Nintendo's website, but that adds nearly 50% to the price and shipping costs. I can possibly understand it for the Circle Pad Pro and Xenoblade, which probably have a limited market, but there is absolutely no good reason why they sold exclusive rights to Kid Icarus 3D Classics, a digitally downloadable game. You can't even purchase it from the eShop. Now, that's no longer true, but at the time he sent us this email, that was the case. Fortunately, my son asked for Kid Icarus Uprising as a birthday gift, so I pre-ordered the game and collected the bonus code for myself. However, this is about the bigger picture. This GameStop exclusivity trend irritates me because I do not shop at that retailer. I don't like their business practices, therefore I don't patronize them. If Nintendo moves towards a more exclusive relationship with GameStop, then I will have to spend my gaming dollars elsewhere. Hey, Guillaume, I heard that you have strong feelings about this.
Well, I did a month ago when this email came out, but now I barely recall my rant.
Hey, we're catching up, you know.
But basically, like, the situation is even more screwed up when you think that this whole exclusivity is, like, for all of North America. And GameStop did buy EB Games, so they do have, like, the stores in Canada. Like, it's the same website and everything. There's still EB Games, but it's really GameStop. But they didn't have this deal. You couldn't pre-order the game and get the Kid Icarus code at EB Games, which really, you know, like, so not only is it retailer exclusive, but it's retailer exclusive in the US and the rest of the continent get screwed. I'm not sure if you could purchase it though. Like I admit I never looked because I, you know, don't often patronize EB Games / GameStop either. But still, like, it's the whole principle of the thing. Just like you would think that it would be in Nintendo's best interest to try to get these eShop virtual console games out there to drum up interest for their retail release, right? And yet, like, it's done so backwards. Like, the game came out really, like, became available on, available on the eShop only 2 weeks after the release of Uprising. Mm-hmm. Why does Nintendo have to do it this way, you know?
Well, I know why they did it. And, I mean, I can certainly explain that part. I don't know if I can defend it, because I don't really agree with them doing these exclusive things. And you know, Nintendo's certainly not the only company doing this. A lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But this is a fairly new trend for Nintendo, and so if you're primarily a Nintendo consumer, you may not have been exposed to this kind of thing very much in the past. The reason, and Kid Icarus is a weird example. You know, I mean, it's a game that, you know, you can now purchase for $4 or $5 on eShop. Anybody can. So it was a timed exclusive thing, although that wasn't clear necessarily from the start. We didn't know for sure that you would be able to buy it later. But, you know, in a sense, that was a nice thing that they did, because if you pre-ordered Uprising, then you got this 3D Classics thing for free. So it was a nice bonus for people who could actually access that. I think it was more annoying for people who didn't even want Uprising, or didn't want to pre-order it at GameStop and maybe wanted to buy it somewhere else. They didn't want to feel like they were missing out on this freebie thing, you know? And so mm-hmm. that can be annoying for some people. I completely understand it. But the reason Nintendo did it, I think, is pretty straightforward. And maybe you can understand why they do this kind of thing in general. If you understand the Kid Icarus example, because they wanted GameStop to really push Uprising hard at their stores. And the way they did it is they gave them all these free codes and said, just give these out and the consumers will be more prone to do this whole pre-order thing that you like so much. And then that lets us know that there's really demand for the game, and it helps build up some hype. And it's sort of a way for Nintendo to make sure that GameStop markets the game for them. And Nintendo doesn't necessarily have to pay GameStop directly in order to make that happen. They just give them these free things, and then GameStop, it's sort of already in their interest to promote this thing because it is exclusive. So no one else has it. This is now a competitive advantage they have over other retailers. So they're going to push it as hard as they can. And that means that Nintendo gets somewhat free, or at least cheap, publicity for their game. Now, in the case of Uprising, I'm not sure how well it worked. I don't think the game has sold incredibly well, at least in America. I think it sold like maybe 200,000 copies in about a month. So it's not lighting the charts on fire, but it's certainly doing okay for itself. And ultimately, I think the question is, how many of those copies were sold at GameStop? And that's something that only Nintendo knows, and GameStop, I guess. But that's only something they can evaluate as to whether this was worth whatever animosity it generated from other retailers and from consumers who shopped at other retailers and didn't get their free copy of the NES game. So that's why they do it. I don't think it's a great reason. And I kind of doubt that they really got the benefit that they wanted from this exclusive deal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's their line of thinking, at least.
Well, I understand those reasons, but, like, you've said it yourself, the other consoles, like, they've been doing things like this for a while now. And in a way, like, I've lost my innocence here. I thought, you know, that Nintendo was kind of above that, but really, like, it's just because they didn't really have a way to give us DLC or things like that. So, you know, they didn't. But now, like, they're coming in with the Wii U and the 3DS, and I'm afraid that we're going to find ourselves in another Batman Arkham City situation where, like, every retailer has its own exclusive DLC, and you really have to, like, pre-order the game to get, like, the Catwoman segments and, like, the, you know, which are essential to the game. And, like, I don't want that to happen to Nintendo games. I want them to remain like a complete thing on a disc, or, you know, as a download, but still, right. Like, I don't want them to take the path that some other publishers have taken.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be surprised if they went that far with it. It seems like that. I would be very surprised just because of what they've said in the past about how they don't want DLC. They don't want to get kind of into that sort of business model.
Right, but Nintendo of Japan said that. I'm less sure about Nintendo of America.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, the 3D Kid Icarus, I mean, that's... Not, I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with Kid Icarus Uprising.
Right, yeah, it's a separate game. It's a completely separate game. If you don't get it, it's not that you're not like you're missing out on part of the Uprising experience because you're not.
Yeah, it is actually an extra.
They're not even connected at all.
Yep.
So, yeah, I know. I worry
easily. It's just a freebie. It was meant to be a nice gesture, but if you really hate GameStop, then it comes across a very different way.
Yeah, it just seems like GameStop is kind of their preferred retail partner in general, probably just because they're so huge.
Right. And we didn't know this at the time, but like with Nintendo's plans to make downloadable games available for purchase at retailers, like, do you think that this was a way to test the waters? Like, have GameStop hand out codes for a downloadable game and like how that would work out? Like some sort of test?
Yeah, I thought about that.
Very possible.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it could be completely, you know, they tend to like dip their toe in the pool, so to speak, before they dive headlong into it. So
yeah,
right.
You know, I think the Xenoblade and the Circle Pad Pro are somewhat different cases. I mean, that's something where you know, you can only buy those things from either Nintendo directly or from GameStop. And the reason is that if GameStop didn't, and supposedly the story is GameStop like sort of helped convince Nintendo to release Xenoblade at all in America. I don't know how true that is, but I've heard a lot about that. So it's possible that if it weren't for GameStop, we wouldn't even have an American version of Xenoblade. So I don't know how much you want to complain about that. You know, I mean, you still don't have to buy it from GameStop. You can still get it from Nintendo if you don't want to give GameStop your money. So it's always, that option's always there. And it's going to be there much more so in the future when you can buy literally every game on the eShop. You know, then you never have to go to GameStop or any other store for that matter. You can just buy everything directly from Nintendo if that's what you prefer. So I think this problem is going away in the future to some extent. With hardware stuff like Circle Pad Pro, you know, it's a case of that's a very limited demand accessories. I mean, there's only a certain segment of the population that even knows what that is or that it exists or what it would be used for or would ever want it. It's a very limited number of people. And so Nintendo figures, well, you know, if we ship 100 of these to every Best Buy around North America, most of them are going to sit there on the shelves and then get sold for $1. And then the retailers will hate us. So they don't want to do that. They don't want to have this extensive stock that just gets backed up and never used. So they figure, you know, let's send it to... Here's the thing. If you even know what the Circle Pad Pro is and you've considered buying one, then you know where your local GameStop is, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the reason that they're kept there, because it's a limited distribution deal. It sort of limits the liability and the cost for Nintendo to make these and to ship them out, because it's much more controlled environment than trying to send them out to every single store around the country that sells video games.
But at the same time, it maximizes the reach.
Exactly. Yeah. It's still like a continent wide chain. So they can still get it out to all the different parts of the market that people would want it. But there's no sense in them sending 1,000 Circle Pad Pros to my town, you know, cause there's probably only 10 people here who actually want one. And so it makes more sense to send it to one store and all of them are kept there. And if you want one, you know that you can go there and get it. So it's just a case of it being of like a very limited appeal kind of item, you know, and Xenoblade is maybe the same way. I think it's some of those things also apply to Xenoblade, but there's also the possibility that GameStop wanted the deal on Xenoblade because they felt that they could push it, you know, or they felt that they could sell enough copies to make it worthwhile. And we still don't really have sales data on Xenoblade, so it's really kind of hard to say how that whole strategy worked out. But ultimately, for the consumer, it's a good thing either way, because if you want to play Xenoblade, now you can pretty much anywhere in the world. And that may not have been the case without GameStop, but that's one of those kind of backroom deals that we'll never know for sure, you know. But I think the number of people who would have ever bought Xenoblade at Walmart is so low that Nintendo's not really sacrificing a whole lot if they don't sell it at Walmart, you know? This is one of those things. So, I don't know if we're going to see more of this in the future. I kind of hope not, but in some cases it could be a good thing. That's kind of my point. I mean, I would prefer they partnered with a different retailer than GameStop, but it's a logical choice. It makes sense. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of competition in the gaming specific retail market, at least in the United States. But at the same time, you know, when GameStop sort of became really big at the time, a lot of this stuff you couldn't really buy at like big box stores. You know, there weren't nearly as many Best Buys. Walmart and Kmart always had these like weird kind of limited selections, Target the same way. And they would always run out of stock or they'd get things late and it was really annoying. And, you know, GameStop, it was kind of a fresh experience to go in there and know that you could kind of get what you want. Now I think a lot of other kinds of stores have caught up and what GameStop does is not as special as it used to be. And so, you know, it's not as big of a deal anymore. Okay, so John has the next letter.
Cliff writes, recently I heard some news about a $99 Xbox 360 with the two-year $15 a month contract that has gotten the web buzzing. I have a take that I don't hear any talk about, and I was wondering if I'm insane or if this thing makes sense. Until now, disc-based consoles haven't had a legitimate claim to them being a service. As iOS updates their games all the time, and I think they are services since you have to connect online. But with consoles like the Xbox 360 and PS3, it is not necessary to connect them online, and you can ignore these features if you wish. I don't think Microsoft gives a hoot about this $100 model in any other capacity than to establish disc-based video game systems as services, positioning themselves with evidence for when the next Xbox comes out so they can lock people out from buying used games and have a legal ground to stand on when GameStop inevitably sues Microsoft for enacting such practices. Even I think it sounds crazy, but I wanted to hear what you guys think.
Well, I don't think GameStop can sue Microsoft if that's the nature of their platform in the next generation. I think there's just tough beans. I don't think there's anything they can do about it. But also I don't think that's going to happen either. There's too much money to be made from people who don't have their systems connected to the internet, you know. What do you guys think about the $99 Xbox 360? I think it's a really bad deal.
Yeah, it's a bad deal. I think it's a good idea, but a bad.
Yeah,
bad
deal. I think it's a good idea, and I think more this will happen more and more. And I think this will be pretty successful for Microsoft because I think they're going to have a way to spin it to consumers that makes it seem like a good deal. It's only a good deal if you think Xbox Live Gold is actually worth paying for. And I don't think it is.
But more details came out since then. And I think that the this model, like this $99 Xbox 360, I think it's only being sold at Microsoft stores, of which there are like 10 on the continent or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's like a test case thing.
I do think it's a good idea and a bad deal. But I am kind of like, it's kind of exciting. I mean, like, what if, like, this could be a solution for the fact that, you know, like, newer, more powerful hardware costs more and more. And, like, these manufacturers want to make the most powerful console that they can, but then they don't want to price themselves out like the Sony did with the PlayStation 3 initially.
Yeah. Right.
So what if like this was the model that they tried to adopt? Like you could still purchase it for like, you know, the Xbox 7020 for like $700, but you could also, you know, pay like $200 and get like some sort of plan.
Yeah. I mean, this only seems like a bad deal because we already know the prices of the pre-existing, you know.
Right. If this was the only way to buy it, then
yeah,
you wouldn't really be able to tell so easily. But I think the comparison to cell phone, the way, you know, I mean, I have an iPhone 4S and I got it subsidized with a plan with Sprint. And I was fine with that because the service that I get with Sprint is required in order to use the device in the first place, right? So it's not a case where, you know, if you don't have a cell phone plan, if you don't have a data plan and a voice plan, then the iPhone is practically worthless. It's a chunk of metal. So you would never really want to buy it without a service plan. Now, I know some people, this is a bigger deal in Europe, I guess, buying the unlocked phones. And, you know, I understand there may be reasons to do that, but I think that's a niche market, especially in North America. But I think the problem with taking this analogy and taking it to video game consoles is that what you do on the system is not traditionally thought of as a service. And I think what Microsoft offers with Live Gold is not nearly enough of a service to make it worth what they're charging. So the idea that it's okay to spend $15 a month to play your Xbox is, to me, that's a really bad deal, because the stuff that you can do with that is not that much different than what you could do if you just didn't pay them anything. Right. And especially when you look at like Sony, I mean, you know, like, here's the thing, like, you know, I've had Gold, and when your Live Gold subscription starts to get towards the end, they start to send you all these really terrorizing emails. Like, look at all the things you're going to miss out on. And like, the number one thing they always put on there is Netflix, because they know that 80% of their users spend a lot of time on Netflix on Xbox 360. The problem is, that is literally the only piece of hardware in the world that I know of that you have to buy a subscription just to use Netflix. It's not your Netflix subscription. You have to subscribe to another service on top of Netflix in order to use Netflix on that system. So the thing that they're holding out as this valuable feature that you're going to lose is something that no one else in the world thinks is actually a valuable feature. And that's kind of my problem with it.
In order for you to think that it has more value, what would they have to add to it in order for you to say, okay, now it's worth it?
I think what they would have to do is do something very much like PlayStation Plus, where they give you free games every month. That's a service. I mean, that just like Gamefly, right? That's you paying a monthly fee and you're getting some games. You may not know exactly what it is, but you know you will get games every month. You will always have something to play on it that you don't have to spend extra money on top in order to get. And they give you deals and stuff like that. That makes sense to me. Paying for online multiplayer, which again is a service that no one else on any device makes you pay an extra fee for, that does not make any sense at all. And the only reason they can do it is because right now they're the most popular console, and they've brainwashed the masses into thinking that all of this stuff is a valid service to pay for when it's really not.
Yeah, I don't get it. Like, have you seen this news report? Like, Microsoft was tooting their own horn by saying that, like, more than half of Gold subscribers more than half of their online users were using the online on the 360 for the entertainment services than, like, for playing multiplayer games.
Yeah.
And they were just like saying, like, well, this clearly shows that blah, blah, blah. We offer a variety of services, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, like, apparently people are really into watching like cricket on ESPN or, you know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Like, I don't have an Xbox, so I don't know what is available. But like, is there really nothing beyond Netflix or?
Well,
like,
I mean, you can get Hulu. You can get HBO Go is on there.
But I can get those on the Wii, on the PS3.
You can get those on the PC.
Well,
exactly.
And again, these are all things that you have to pay an extra subscription fee to the content creator. Like, you can't just pay for Xbox Live Gold and start watching HBO. You have to also pay for HBO. So it's really strange to me that they're making you pay for something on top of all these other services. And that's kind of what bothers me about it. I mean, in from a Nintendo perspective, I don't think you have to worry about this happening anytime soon. Or if you think this is a good thing, I don't think you can look forward to buying a subsidized Wii U anytime soon, because Nintendo has nothing even remotely resembling what you could call an online service that would be worth paying a subscription fee for. And beyond that, they've said consistently over the past 10-15 years that they don't believe in charging people subscription fees to do things online.
Yeah, they are trying to even push towards that, though. Like, they don't want their console to be a set-top box.
No.
It's not their deal.
Look, we're just relieved when we can buy something from the online store without it being a huge fucking hassle. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the point that we have reached right now. And that's far enough as far as I'm concerned. If I can download their, and I'm very happy with what they're doing with putting retail games on the eShop. If I can buy their games digitally without having to put in 5,000 numbers and, you know, scan my thumbprint and make phone calls and stuff like that, that is all I ever want from their online service. If I can do voice chat on games that have online multiplayer and it's not a huge fucking hassle, that is all I want. That is as far as they have to go.
You dream big there.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, on the Wii, all it played was games. Didn't even play, you know, like DVDs or anything like that. So that tells you a lot.
But it does play Netflix. And it does play Hulu Plus now. And it does other things.
Yep.
But they're not trying to charge you for the privilege of using Netflix on your Wii.
Exactly.
Or your 3DS for that matter. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I think the subsidized Xbox is really interesting, and you know, I think it's clearly just an experiment on Microsoft's part right now. They're not trying to make this a really big push, considering they're only selling it in 10 or 12 stores around the country. But it will go wider, and I think there's definitely a market that this is appealing to. And I think there's a way to do this much better than the way that they're doing it currently. And I think it will be, I don't think it's the wave of the future, but I think it will be part of the future of console gaming for sure.
Yeah. I mean, going back to what Guillaume touched on earlier, I mean, really, I think it does remove one of the barriers to people who completely really don't care too much about console gaming.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's like, you know, I don't want to pay $300 for an Xbox 360 or $200, $250, whatever, but it's like, what if it was $100? What if it was less than one of Nintendo's portable consoles?
And once again, John, this is a case where, you know, the idea that Xbox 360 costs $250, $300 is preposterous. That system is 7 years old.
I just want to get it in there that I would kill for a PSN Plus-like service for Nintendo. Just the chance to get like free Snowpack Park 2 on the Wii U or you know, stuff like that. That would be amazing.
You already did. You already got free. It. You already
free
got
this
it for
month.
Free.
Urban Champion.
I think that is one of the choices, actually.
Next month, yep. Kung Fu, yeah. Only on Nintendo Plus. You're $50 a month at work.
Yeah. I think PlayStation Plus is actually a pretty damn good deal. And the only reason I don't have it is because I already have more games than I can play. So the prospect of them feeding me a game that I may or may not be interested in every month, but I'm going to want to play because they gave it to me because I kind of already paid for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really terrifying. I would rather go a la carte.
Yeah, I mean they've improved it quite a bit. I mean, honestly, when I first subscribed to it, I thought it was pretty much a waste.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the games that they're now giving away are actually pretty good.
Yeah, they actually gave out like Trine 2 and Rock of Ages also this month.
Yep. Jeez, Trine 2 is baller, awesome game. So
yeah, I gotta check that out.
And all these things, I mean, they're not like time limited. As long as you download it within the period that it's offered, you can keep it. And as long as you stay subscribed, you can play it anytime you want to. So look, if you have a really insatiable gaming habit, PlayStation Plus is a fantastic deal.
Yep.
It's just, but if I only owned a PlayStation 3, I would definitely take advantage of it. But having about five different platforms I can buy video games on, I can't make it worth my while because I would be too stressed out trying to play everything that they feed you.
Yeah, I pretty much download them all and they just sit on my hard drive, so.
Do you unwrap them at least as you let them sit in your virtual shelf?
I do.
He installs them at least.
I look at them. I'll boot them up once, maybe sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, Guillaume, can you read the next email, please?
Tyson writes, just wanted to let you know that we have done a ton of content for Pandora's Tower over at Operation Rainfall's website. In last week's episode of your podcast, with the letter discussing the title, I felt I should bring this up. We have an article with a roundtable discussion about the ways in which Pandora's Tower could be published that paralleled much of what Johnny said. We have a three-part article/roundtable series about why Pandora's Tower matters as a niche title, a dark title on a family-friendly console, and as the first original IP from an up-and-coming developer fostered under Nintendo. We have a three-part audio series that discusses the use of classic music in the game and explores the origins of the pieces being used. Just a ton of content that the staffers at Operation Rainfall have put out in order to address the weakest link mentality that many seem to apply to the game. Since I have played the game myself, I would agree with the listener whose letter you read last week, Pandora's Tower is my second favorite of the three.
After Xenoblade, I assume.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, we know that at least a couple of the people from Operation Rainfall listen to the podcast, and I always like to hear from them. I like to hear what they're doing because I hadn't been over to their website in quite a while. And I didn't know that they were doing this kind of ongoing coverage of these games and providing so much content. So, you know, thought it would be a good service to our listeners to let them know if you. And we have a review up of Pandora's Tower that just went up in the past week or so. So you should definitely check that out. But if you want to know even more about the game, you know, head over to Operation Rainfall's actual website. I guess there's quite a bit of stuff over there, it sounds like. I didn't know about any of that, and I'm going to have to go check it out because definitely after hearing that email a few weeks ago, I'm kind of like, you know, I've already modded my Wii to play Xenoblade. It wouldn't be a big deal for me to import Pandora's Tower at this point. And, you know, it sounds pretty interesting. So maybe I'm going to finish Xenoblade first. But after that, maybe I will consider doing that.
Yeah, and like Operation Rainfall, like they had some sort of Kickstarter where they wanted to basically pitch publishers about like the idea of publishing the game in North America. And wow, they had like, you could get like this kind of collector's box set for the three Operation Rainfall titles if you gave them money.
Yeah, they're a very interesting story. I think it's I've kind of watched them for a while, and it's interesting. They're sort of one of the first groups to really make a splash in terms of being kind of almost an activist group. They are an activist group, but it's just, you know, usually like up to this point, it's been like, someone, you know, puts something up, on some page somewhere. Hey, sign your name. If, you know, we're going to send this off to Nintendo. And it never really goes anywhere. But what they've actually done is really had a really good impact. And what I like to see is that they're, you know, they didn't just do it for one title and drop it. It looks like they're going to keep going as an activist group. So it's almost like an interesting watchdog group, which the game industry really hasn't had kind of this kind of like a consumer advocacy group. I just find it's very, very interesting that this is something, you know, this just, kind of in the vein of Kickstarter, sort of grassroots, taking it to the publishers, where the publishers don't necessarily call all of the shots anymore. There is sort of an element of the fans kind of speaking up and saying, hey, we want this. You don't tell us what we want. We tell you what we want. So I think it's good to see them, you know, continuing with all of these other games. I hope.
The guys who started it are from my old stomping grounds, IGN.
Nice.
Yeah, they're from the forums.
I think what they're doing is awesome. And I think they're doing it in a classy way, which is, you know, what we need. We need these guys to be sort of paragons of the community and to share their message in a respectful way, and to get people doing, you know, get people contacting these publishers in a way that's constructive and not annoying or spam. And they've done a really nice job of kind of shepherding that process and making sure that it's done properly. And they've been obviously pretty successful, I think, in getting the word out and sort of starting this viral campaign. And also, as I now know, as I've been educated by Tyson, actually covering the games and continuing to try to, you know, build up awareness of what these games are about and get people to want to try to play them. And I looked up this thing, Guillaume, you were mentioning. It's actually not at Kickstarter. It's not an official Kickstarter. It's a Kickstarter style program that Operation Rainfall is doing themselves internally. You can only do it on their own website. And they explain why that is the case if you go there. It's mainly because they don't actually own the games, the rights to the games. So right. It's something they're doing sort of on their own. But it looks like a pretty cool program. You might want to go check it out. But yeah, I love what they're doing, and you know, I hope it's something that maybe even will extend beyond these three games. You know, certainly it makes sense that the whole thing kind of congealed around this trio of games, because you know, they really did seem like things that we had not gotten much of at all in the West, and that were sort of being hoarded over in Japan, and that people over here, you know, maybe a small but significant minority of players would really enjoy and would really want to get behind. So, you know, this all starts with, you know, people in Japan making really good video games. You know, if that doesn't happen, then the whole Operation Rainfall thing would be pointless, because they'd be games that we wouldn't care about whether they came out here or not. Right. So they have to be desirable games. And I think this is definitely a program that could extend and definitely into the future, as long as they're careful about choosing the right games to get behind. You know, if they really do their research and they build up this hype and they really put their efforts behind games that people actually should care about and will care about when they finally come out. I think, you know, this is something they could keep going beyond just the three games that they started with. It's really good. So good to hear from them. And that's going to wrap up our show this week. As always, you can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or head over to the show notes for this episode at NWR. And there'll be a link there you can click and type your email right into the website, and we get those too. As always, we would love, especially now that we're sort of starting turning over a new leaf and starting anew, we would love to remind you to head over to iTunes and write a review and rate the podcast. We would very much appreciate that. It is a big driver of new listeners to this show. You can also check out a brand new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition with our friend Michael TYP Cole. He joins Zach Miller from Connectivity, and they play music from video games and talk about them. It's a really good episode. I listened to it this morning. There's also some fun stuff brewing over at the Connectivity podcast. They just started a new bi-weekly news digest called Connectabytes. That's the new title, Connectabytes. And they're very short, like 15-minute news briefs on what's been happening in the world of Nintendo that they're kind of doing in advance of E3, because all this crazy news is always popping up all the time. So that's definitely worth checking out. We've got the Famicast coming about once a month. I believe the new one is sort of being recorded and edited right around now, so it probably won't be too much longer before you hear from the Famicast again. And I would also love to direct you over to my other sister sort of side project called Discover Music Project. That's over at crosstalk.com with a W. And or you can just search for it on iTunes. And on the newest episode of Discover Music Project, I play some more music from one of my all-time favorite bands, Robert Randolph and the Family Band. And on a recent episode, we did Regina Spektor as well. So there's always some really good stuff going on there. And I'm lining up some really awesome guests to do additional episodes coming up soon. And of course, you can like us on Facebook. We post post little updates on there throughout the week whenever there's anything to announce about RFN. You can follow us on Twitter, and now all four members of the podcast are on Twitter. So Guillaume, what is your handle? That's most importantly, that's what people need to know.
Yeah, I changed it recently. The whole Pandarius Rex thing was really just because I couldn't get the Pandarius alone. It's already taken. Now it's Pandarius NWR. PANDARUS.
And also, Johnny, at your behest, you told me to plug my blog, so it is www.MrDiamondJ.com. Same as my Twitter.
So that's MR Diamond and the letter J.
Yep, I kind of like reserve that for non-video game stuff, but, you know, that might creep on there a little bit. Mostly it's going to be sports, music, whatever the hell I want to put on it, really. It's my blog.
Yeah. I saw you write some stuff about gaming, though, a little bit.
Yep.
Oh, you're Oblivion. You posted some stuff about Oblivion on there that I was reading.
Yes, the sad tale of how I came to my my currently stalled state in Oblivion once again.
Yeah, and John's a really good writer. It's too bad, John, you don't get to write as much as you used to, because you're a very good writer, and I was reminded of that when I was browsing through your blog. Very nice. Okay, that's all the plugs. Thank you, everybody, for listening and for bearing with us as we reorient ourselves a little bit. It only gets better, and especially next week when we have James Jones returning to the show. Look forward to it, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Later.
Bye.